Once again, if it's a Friday morning, that means it's time for David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. David joins us every Friday. You can find David at his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a reporter for PBS on ethics and belief. And we have quite a few interesting stories to see how the media has spread them out itself out today, David.
Sure, I'm glad to be joining my fellow media observer, Marshall Miles, as I report in again from the media capital of the world. But I think we can't fail to recognize, Marshall, the redolent date, February 24th. It marks 1 year exactly since Russia's Vladimir Putin launched his own full-scale war in Ukraine. And of course, our media are falling over themselves to observe this anniversary. You know, an almost festive air was built up with the showy flourish of President Biden's tightly media-managed and surprise train journey to Kyiv to get ahead of this red letter day. What I'm saying might sound like I'm suggesting that for the media this is some kind of big birthday celebration, which is unfair, of course. I mean, the date obviously and quite rightly offers an occasion for the kind of considered reflection and interpretation that everyday news coverage will rarely provide. So 24th of February, yeah, it's getting a lot of extra attention. But maybe we need to first acknowledge that, you know, there's an unavoidable calendar truth alongside it, or predates it, in fact. Russia's use of military force against Ukraine could better be dated to its seizure of Crimea 9 years ago, not one. That previous Putin land grab, along with his simultaneous military support for separatists in the east of Ukraine, just reflected Russia's deep paranoia about being victimized by an aggrandizing United States and Western Europe. But the current full-on warfare that began a year ago was another, and in this case, thrashing, bullying, and interestingly, tellingly incompetent outgrowth from that same sullen perception of victimhood by Russia. I mean, the paranoia is, I would say, fundamental to the Kremlin's thinking, and evidently nowhere more sharply than in Putin's own obsessive mind. And this was amply demonstrated in this week's video from Moscow. You probably saw it. The president's delayed by war speech, interesting, self-satisfying speech to the Russian parliament, the Duma. But of course, all eyes are really turning to Ukraine and its population. Their valiant response over the year has, of course, been lauded in much of the international press. Ukrainians both won the Western world support and at the same time further buoyed up their own national unity and cohesion. There's one thing that I think could have been more widely reported, but there was an undernoticed opinion survey in Ukraine conducted right during the barrages of Russian artillery and missiles and drones. And it reached a finding that's really well worth reflecting on. The Kyiv International Institute of Sociology did the survey, and it posed an eyebrow-raising, I mean, almost offensively inappropriate question. The question was to Ukrainians, each individual Ukrainian that they asked was, do you consider yourself a happy person? Well, you know, in late 22, in the midst of all that bombardment they were suffering, a remarkable nearly 70% of Ukrainians answered that they did see themselves as happy. A dramatic increase, incidentally, from only about half, 50%. Back in 2017. I mean, that's a remarkable finding. And you could argue, I suppose, that sheer adrenaline along with the heightened sense of communal purpose might help to account for such cheeriness. I mean, it certainly has echoes with a, a conviction, you know, that's shared amongst a lot of my fellow Brits. It's all born of a maybe mythic, but certainly well recorded good spirits amongst Londoners while Adolf Hitler was blitzing the city back in 1940. Now, the conclusion often drawn by war commentators from evidence like this is that you simply cannot bomb a civilian population into submission. And that seems to be well demonstrated elsewhere. I mean, Vietnam in 1965 through 68, of course, that bombing campaign. But although I have to admit, there are some counterexamples like President Bashar al-Assad's horribly successful pummeling of his rebellious fellow Syrians. And, you know, we should note, I suppose, that Vladimir Putin had a hand in that too. But I see that I see the fact that Ukraine has suffered this for a year now. It's very, very clear that what we're witnessing is a proxy war of a kind, and we can recognize this. So it is Russia against the US and its allies, with Ukraine as the proxy, and we can recognize this without signing on to Putin's paranoid belief that NATO is hell-bent on destroying a once proud Russian empire. I'm afraid it's a reflection, I have to say, as I consider it in the context of war analysis over the centuries, is that it reaffirms for us two truths that I bring forward from all the studies that there have been about war and governance. And I'd quote two time-honored analysts from different periods of history. First, Machiavelli, when he said, with a kind of dour reflection, reflecting on the impossibility of ever banishing war from humanity, he said there was no avoiding war, it can only be postponed. And the other one is Thucydides, who said that the whole reason for the Athenian Sparta, you know, the great Peloponnesian War of Greece, it was the rise of Athens and the fear instilled in Sparta about that rise that made war inevitable. We can understand, without necessarily sympathizing with it, that we have a very classic situation here with Russia's paranoia and the West's considerable progress.
What's interesting to note is that I would have expected the response that they got from the Ukrainians simply because they were now in war and they simply don't want to go back to what once was. And this pointed it out more than ever, why they are happy, and why they are proud and why they're defending themselves. And the interesting thing about all of this is that NATO had it was very smart when NATO was first founded. It was meant to prevent an all-out war in Europe, and it's funny because that's one of the miscalculations that Putin had, and all I can say is it's a good thing that the president that's in office now is in office, because it emboldened NATO to come together again like they haven't been in years, and to realize that their mission is not out of date and will never be out of date. It's a mission of not conquering, but it's a mission of holding the peace for a majority of people who live in Europe, in free Europe.
Sure, it's a defensive alliance and doing that job very effectively. Though, you know, in this case, being more of a cheerleader, I suppose, the NATO countries, including the United States, of course, being cheerleaders more than fully engaged supporters. And of course, nobody on the NATO side wants to get into an active war itself. And there we have the kind of standoff that it seems to be settling into being, although, of course, with very active onslaughts going on with a big offensive being predicted right now as we speak by Russia and very determined efforts with new Western military equipment support on the Ukrainian side. It's a standoff and a bloody standoff for the involved combatants, and we in the rest of the world look on in horror, but aware that what's being attempted here is some kind of containment. And at some point, and we don't know when that is, but at some point there will have to be a negotiated settlement. But for the moment, that's a long way off, and the battles must inevitably continue.
And another misstep. Now the association of basically Vladimir Putin's private mercenary group Wagner, they see how incapable the Russian military command is, and what happened with the head of Wagner showing pictures of their dead on the battlefield, and basically saying to Russia, "You did this by not supplying enough ammunition."
A terrible spat between the mercenaries and the official military forces of Russia. It's an extraordinary scene of internecine conflict within the ranks of the aggressors. It's no way, you might say, if you were a general, this is no way to fight a war. And yet the war is being fought this way, in this extraordinarily incompetent way, but bludgeoning, you know, has its effect. And we see a situation in which it's deplorable in every direction.
Well, it's a situation, as you look back over the course of a year, and you just wonder, it's a far different outlook now than when the war started. And I'm sure in another year, if it goes that long, which it probably will, it will once again have a far different look as to what we think might happen.
Yeah, there are always surprises in war, but looking at it at the moment, the drift seems to be towards an acknowledgement that Russia is not going to get what it intended to get in the first place, and that when we come to count the cost at the end of it, will it have all have been worthwhile for either side? It's never easy to tell after a war, but that's clearly the way it's going to go, and it's going to go for some time now. That's the regrettable thing. But let's turn to the United States. I suppose we're looking now at the great issues besetting the world at large. But we can turn to the sordid details of a domestic United States story. The troubles of Trump world continue to mount up precariously, not least in legal arenas. The former first daughter and son-in-law Ivanka and Jared Kushner are now being subpoenaed by the special counsel Jack Smith as he investigates Father Trump's efforts to cling to power after losing the 2020 election. And this comes on the heels of the same counsel's subpoena of the former vice president, Mike Pence, who's trying to resist appearing before the counsel's grand jury. The media have not discovered yet whether the Kushners will do the same as Mike Pence, or more likely, it's being said, will do what they did with the House of Representatives Committee and actually give evidence under oath. Much of that video evidence, you'll remember, was run and rerun during public proceedings of that committee. Trouble for the Trump world. And we shouldn't forget either that only last week, a Georgia grand jury found that perjury was committed by at least one witness they heard from, you know, amongst Trump's helpers during their investigation into that same 20 election result, but in the state of Georgia. And that cloud of perjury hovers over several of Trump's helpers, and notably his former lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, former many things, really, including even former so-called America's mayor, Giuliani's, we are waiting to hear the outcome of the grand jury's recommendation and whether it applies to Giuliani. But possibly, of course, it could include prosecution. And Georgia state law, I should point out, prescribes for anyone found guilty in a case like this of perjury, the penalty is 1 to 5 years in prison. And on top of all this, let me just point out that there's yet another grand jury, now one in here in my home neighborhood of Manhattan, that's been impaneled and is now considering criminal charges, which may include ones against Donald Trump himself, around the question, did he and his business illegally falsify business records to cover up payments made to the performer, I think it's the best word, performer Stormy Daniels, payments made, we should remember, by Trump's other personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, recently freed after 3 years in prison. I mean, I did say as we began this topic that there are sordid details, but they're all piling up now and making life all that much more difficult for Trump, and of course the 2024 campaign that he launched back in November.
And to show the disorganization, Donald Trump showed up in that town that had the train accident, and he brought Trump water to these people, and criticized Joe Biden for not being there. But what Donald Trump forgets is, first of all, there were, I think, 4 or 5 toxic train accidents when he was president. And not once did he go to any of those. But once again, it wouldn't have been a bad idea for him to go there. But then again, to hand out Trump water, he has a way of turning possibly good press into absolutely horrible press.
Well, Trump is Trump, yes. And the Palestine, East Palestine trail wreck with all its environmental pollution is just one horrible instance of how not to run a railroad for a start, and how not to run environmental protection. And of course, we know that Trump has no good record at all in the environmental protection world. But it's not been handled very well by the Trump administration either, to be perfectly honest. The EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has not come out of this looking well. But at least there is now, thanks to a lot of very close and attentive media investigation, some clear sense of what finally turned out to be the case. The cause of the crash itself is now becoming clear through the obvious and unavoidable investigation by NTSB, showing now that there was plenty of warning for what might go wrong with a train load that size and containing all that hazardous material.
And of course, you can go back to the Trump administration, where they really did gut a lot of DEA rules, not only on cars and trucks, but also on trains, as a matter of fact. So, it all comes back to once again a sad story, and there were plenty of outs that we didn't have to get to that point in the sad story.
Absolutely. Speaking of Palestine, as it's pronounced in Ohio, I think we should not omit the seriousness of the Israeli-Palestinian situation, the Palestine of the Middle East. I know you keep a wary eye on that situation, and it's continuing now to crank up seriously in its tension and outright violence. The current round of violence spiked last month when the Israelis launched a major attack on the refugee camp of Jenin. And now comes this week a deadly raid by Israel on the Palestinian city of Nablus, killing 11 people and injuring a reported 100. The Israelis took no casualties whatever. Looking on from Washington, it seems the U.S. can only make its usual sort of tut-tutting sounds about actions by this new hard right coalition government of Benjamin Netanyahu. I noticed that State Department spokesperson in a press conference, Ned Price, said that the United States recognizes Israel's security concerns, but is also deeply concerned by the large number of injured and the loss of civilian lives in the Nablus raid. And meanwhile, of course, there have been individual attacks by Palestinians on Israeli citizens, some with the hallmarks of lone wolf operators and some more organized. And of course, there continues to be, and ratcheted up now by this current atmosphere, rocket attacks fired from the Palestinian enclave of Gaza. It's all looking more and more serious, and it can't, you know, it inevitably prompts the thought that some terrible new worsening of the entire situation is very imminent. Perhaps even another intifada that some commentators are suggesting might be in the making right now.
Well, another interesting week to see how the media has done, and I'm sure next week they won't let us down, and there'll be more incredible stories to follow, David.
More difficult and testing stories to follow, absolutely. I look forward to talking to you next week.
All right, speak to you next week, David.
Bye.